Hi, I'm Magda.
And I'm Katie, your co-host.
How We Built Our Team is a podcast that talks to successful founders and leaders in the hiring and recruiting space to learn their strategies for building and scaling their teams.
From attracting and impressing top talent to creating a strong company culture, our guests will share their insights and experience on what it takes to build your dream team.
Welcome to How We Built Our Team. Today we have Melissa Karjanakis. She's an executive coach to world-class founders and is currently the head of BizOps at Cloudflare and was formerly founder and CEO of Scriptswap. So she loves helping founders with fundraising, specifically go-to-market, finding product market fit, operational excellence, like OKRs and KPIs, and helping them be confident and authentic B2B salespeople. She has thought very intentionally about building remote teams, which is why we're super excited to talk to her about that today on the podcast. So Melissa, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So let's just dive right in. I want to know a bit more about the company that you founded, Scriptswap. What did you aim to achieve when you were launching that company?
My number one goal was to make all information actually understandable and therefore usable and useful for all people, because there's a lot of information available, but if it isn't useful and usable to you, you may as well not have access to it. So the original premise of the company was kind of like Google Translate, and you could input any information and it would change it from, you know, grade 12 English to grade 10, grade 8, grade 5, grade 3. So simplifying anything.
That's awesome. So it was helping people be better communicators, essentially, through their written word.
Yeah, most of our use cases were in contracts. So for example, a very complicated MSA agreement, you could just input it and then it would be completely rewritten at a lower reading level. Now that seems like, well, of course these things can happen, but certainly in 2018, 19, we were absolutely ahead of the curve.
Totally. Yeah, that's awesome.
And when you were building Scriptswap out, I know you were really focused on building remote teams that were connected and, you know, that's not always easy, especially if you're doing it back then before the times of COVID. Can you share a little bit more about your philosophy around building remote teams and remote work? And I'm also curious to know, what do you feel leaders are getting wrong about it?
Great question. So my philosophy was always quite simple in the sense that we wanted to attract the best talent wherever they were. And I wanted to create jobs in the knowledge economy for people outside of major urban centers. I don't believe that innovation should be reserved for the Toronto, LA, New York, Montreal, Vancouver's of the world, or San Francisco. It should be available to anyone, anywhere. We had those tools. I could see this back in 2015, 16, which is why I expressly left Toronto, moved back to Sault Ste. Marie, Ontario to try to start this business. And I wanted to be a globally competitive AI company in 2016 in Sault Ste. Marie. Obviously, things played out a little differently, but we did manage to have a remote first team. And it was extremely intentional. So some of the philosophies around that, there are three main things, and I have talked about this before, but the three main things for a successful remote team are, number one, values. You have to have clear core values. When you're in a remote team, it's generally a results-based environment. This both relieves pressure for folks because it's not about, am I clocking in? How long have I been here? It's, did I get the work done that we needed to get done? Are we on track? Are we on schedule? Great. Then maybe I might, you know, go hang out with my kids a little early today. Or are we behind? Great. Well, then maybe I'm going to work a little extra. And acknowledging that ebb and flow, particularly within startups. So that's number one. Number two is scheduling absolutely everything. And if you look at my calendar, I have everything from when I exercise, making sure I have breakfast, commuting times, extracurriculars. I'm doing a lot of singing and choirs and musical theater shows now. And all of that is in there end to end. Even when I need to take breaks, lunch, I have my Fitbit go off and be like, it's 12:30. Did you eat? And if I didn't, I'm like, well, better get up and go eat. Right? So scheduling everything, including emergent time. I have had blocks in my calendar for years called emergent time every single week for a few hours one day so that there is that time for when things come up, and also scheduling work time. Right now, today, I don't take meetings on Tuesday. You want to meet with me on Tuesday? That's nice. I'm not meeting with you on Tuesday because I'm getting work done. And the third and final thing is over-communicating. Particularly in a remote environment, people receive information in different ways. I'm very much a verbal processor, which you'll get from this podcast as we riff together. Some people prefer written, and written is always really important, particularly in a business context. What did you agree upon? What was said? Where's that history? But sometimes a quick little video can explain something in 30 seconds that would take you like 5 minutes to write. So often in over-communicating, I'll pair different modes of communication in one. So doing a quick 2-minute video, here's how to do this. Here's what I need you to do, team. And then bulleted list of, well, what is the summary and what are the instructions? So those are the three important points of remote work, which is one, know your values, have strong values and co-create them. Two, scheduling absolutely everything and being very structured. And three, over-communicating. Now, where I think people are getting it wrong, which is the second part of your question, you're seeing these weird hybrids that are not particularly inclusive, but you actually can do hybrids in a very inclusive manner. That's what we did. You're also seeing, well, we used to be always in the office, then we were always not in the office, and now we're just always going to be in the office again. And to me, that's extremely short-sighted in the sense of people have other demands, people have life, and I guarantee you that by not commuting, not getting dressed, particularly for women, not doing this whole frou-frou that we have to do to be professional. I mean, even now, this is my first podcast I've done with curly hair, inspired by Arlene Dickinson. I kid you not, because I was like, I don't have the time to spend 30 minutes straightening my hair today. But normally I always would, right? Because it's a taboo. So all of this ridiculousness, you save, and you're getting extra time to work, to be productive, to be concentrated on that work. Is in-person time important? Absolutely, hands down. And what we did at ScriptSwap was I would fly the team together from wherever for a 1 to 1.5 week window, sometimes as short as 4 days, on about a quarterly cadence. And then with Cloudflare, we are, thank goodness, not required to go in the office. But guess what? We do. Because people want to be there from time to time when we can. That's not every day of the week, and that's not every week. But sometimes if I go in on a Tuesday, then I'll go in Wednesday, Thursday. I'm like, oh, this is great. And sometimes I won't go in for 2 weeks because I really just needed to focus and get work done. And so having an all or nothing mentality is where people are getting it wrong. Not having the structures in place to bring people together in person, because that does still matter, is another area where people are getting it wrong. And going back to the philosophy and principles, there's a way to do it and way to do it really, really well.
That was a great answer. A very, very thorough. And it's really cool to kind of hear some of the mini examples that you've experienced at ScriptSwap and at Cloudflare. I'm curious if we can kind of break down each of those three steps a little bit more. Like in the first step, you know, it's really important to prioritize your company's values and live by those values. Can you maybe share a bit more about how you came up with your values or any tactics that you found were really helpful in doing that?
Absolutely. I was an extremely intentional CEO, and looking back and even re-listening to some podcasts ahead of this recording, I was like, dang, that was great. So even back at, you know, 26, 27, I knew enough to co-create. Yes, there needs to be leadership from the top down, but you need your team to co-create with you because, and you'll read about this everywhere, you know, startups are very much the who, not just the what. They are who is involved, and every hire matters. We were 60% women and I believe 30% visible minority. That was ridiculously important to me. But then when you have all those different voices co-creating your values, it's really important. So how we did it was from day one, and we would refresh this when we got together quarterly and say, hey, are these values still what works for us, especially as the team expanded? But right from the first days, there were five of us right at the beginning and flew everyone together, and we had a session on values, and I paid a coach to walk us through that because I very much believe, especially as a CEO, you get absolute bang for your buck when you're bringing in facilitators that you can participate and not lead. So that's tip number one. Any sessions you're doing with your startups, when you're taking the time to come together, particularly in a remote first environment, just hire the facilitators. Very much worth it, especially the good ones. And so the facilitator would bring us through an exercise where we were putting up our values. And the three values that we came up with at ScriptSwap were considerate, because we're not a family, we're not besties, we're working together. But we also want to be considerate. We don't need to be best friends, but we need to be considerate of each other's time, considerate of each other's workflows. That also means if you're waiting on me and you're relying on me, I'm going to get done what you need, or I'm going to, at the minimum, update you so that you can do the next step in that process. That's considerate. The second was communicate. Again, that goes back to my piece about over communicating. And part of how I did that, I had two meeting structures. I swear to God, even when we got to like 23 people, they were like 12 minutes long. And I would run through each section of the company. And one was a compass calibration of where are we at? What are we thinking, you know, from the view from the top or from a leadership perspective? How is every area of the company going so that everyone was aware and we were all up to date? And certainly, you know, with Cloudflare, this continues every week. We have company-wide all hands. And I think that's very important and very incredible in that communication so people understand what's going on. And then the third value that we had, which is unusual for a startup, was sustainable pace. So one of the other things I had that added to the diversity of my team was we represented, I think, every age decade from your 20s to your 70s. You do not see that in startups. And so to be a very early stage startup with every age demographic represented, people in their 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, all very different needs, very different stages in life, very different levels of experience that we had to bring. And we needed it to be a sustainable pace for everyone, because at every decade, there are reasons why you need it to be a sustainable pace, not to avoid burnout, to be able to spend time with your kids, because you're enjoying a little more and maybe semi-retired, right? And like an expert, so one of our plain language experts absolutely provided the plain language expertise, but not necessarily needs to be every day in every dev scrum, right? And so those were the three values. That was how we came up with them, by being together, being in person, narrowing down from a very big list, and leveraging a facilitator to help us do that.
That's incredible advice to hire an expert to come in and provide the structure so you as a leader can participate and really do it with the team. I think that's probably very underrated and something a lot of people don't consider. It's really cool as well that you had people from every decade. Definitely takes intention when building a startup to do that. I'm also curious on the second point, kind of on the overall framework to focus on calendaring everything. You're obviously the type of person who thrives in that, but that is different for each person. And I know for myself, sometimes I'll calendar a block to work on something and work on something else. So how did you help people with kind of different working styles adopt that and prioritize, you know, what mattered to them, where maybe instead of going to musical theater, they're prioritizing a family event or something? How did you help people on your team do that as well?
So there are a few different ways that you can do that. And the first and foremost is having core working hours that overlap. This works for certain time zones, certainly not every time zone. But Eastern time to Pacific time in the Americas, which is predominantly where we were hiring, you can do a nice overlap. And so we had set hours where we knew we would be available and be able to work. And from a calendaring perspective, sure, I fall into the same trap as you. Gotta work on this thing. Worked on something else. You know, the productive procrastination I'm sure we've all heard about. And as long as you're hitting your goals, right, in a results-based culture, that's fine to me. And I think, again, not everyone on the team was probably calendaring to the extent that I was. And that's okay. But what we needed calendared as a team and the core overlapping work hours were there. I also had a company-wide calendar that had people's work blocks. So sure, you could go look at their calendar, but if they didn't have it there, you could go look at this master calendar that would say, when is it so-and-so's focus time? And so we always knew, and a lot of those times conveniently overlapped for focus time. And you would know not to bug this person or that person because they are heads down, deep work doing things. And even in the way you communicate, I don't remember if Slack could do this at the time. I don't think so, but like delayed email sends, although internally we only ever did Slack. So external communication, email, internal Slack. And so delaying email sends so that, especially if I'm getting ideas late at night, I'm not bothering people at that time. You're sending them during work hours and out of their work blocks. Or even now, I believe Slack does allow you to delay send messages. So that's just super important of like, oh, it's in my mind now. I need to get it out of my head. But they're in a deep work block, so I'm not going to do that. So those are just some of the tips that really helped us.
Yeah, that's awesome. I've never heard the term productive procrastinator before, but I'm definitely one of those people where I will swap in other tasks instead of doing the tasks I'm supposed to be doing, which still makes you feel like you've accomplished something, I guess. But in terms of your third point there, over communicating and also sharing things in different mediums is something that you brought up. And that makes me think about accessibility, helping people who or might be neurodivergent and might learn things differently. So you've written about this before, but I'm curious to hear in your own words about you on how remote work makes things more equitable.
So the equity and inclusion piece in terms of communication style specifically, when you have remote work, you're almost forced into more written communication and you're forced into a little bit more async at times. And that also forces you not to be off the cuff. It forces you to be more thoughtful and a little bit more rigorous in the way that you're dealing with things. And so how some of it began with ScriptSwap was accidental, right? I'm making these videos. They're 1 to 2 minutes long, showing a thing, explaining a concept, asking for a thing to be done. But I wouldn't do the bulleted list, which I talked about earlier. And then, you know, my team members are like, hey, like, cool, but could we have like a bulleted list summary as well? And then now it's easier, but certainly, you know, auto-generating closed captions, you don't even have to listen to the audio. I believe that increased written communication is much more accessible because even for people who may have visual impairments, you can have screen readers and other tools to really help make it better. And I can't tell you the number of times that even in meetings today, we'll turn on captions because for some people, they're just so much more visual. It's easier to read and listen at the same time. And so I believe that remote work can be done in a way that is much more equitable. In the past, I've said remote work is a feminist choice, but it really depends on how you're doing it, right? Because we saw during the pandemic, and Reshma Saujani does a fantastic job of this, talking about how, well, actually it wasn't because in the pandemic when everything was closed and it was a different kind of remote work than what I always did or envisioned before, how we operated in 2018 and 19, you know, the burdens of household work were just 24/7 and they fell onto predominantly mothers, but parents felt that way more than people like me who were not parents during the pandemic. And you're suddenly parent, school teacher, cleaner, chef, and working a full-time job. It's ridiculous. And so having that written communication allows for async. It allows for accessibility tools like screen readers, and it is just a much more inclusive way of operating. And again, those multiple mediums kind of came up by accident. And now I'll just speak to very briefly at Cloudflare. There's a lot of really structured templates that I really love using in terms of if this is a thing we want to do, these are what the business partners need to know. These are the core questions that I need to answer. I need to write them down and make sure that people have them. And then if I can answer those questions, then they're going to do the work. But if I haven't thought through enough to answer those questions, I have no business asking anybody to do that work. And that's a very wise way of working.
Yeah, I love that. And in terms of that remote work is a feminist choice, and then sort of curtailing that with the added domestic labor that came with the pandemic. I've heard a lot about and read a lot about this, but the sort of like emotional labor that women specifically or people who identify as women take on in a remote environment, especially when you're left with, you know, Zoom calls and trying to navigate how people communicate over Slack and what the subtext of XYZ means. Have you encountered that issue and how have you dealt with that personally as a founder?
As a founder, I think it's complicated because you are the leader, you are helping set the tone for culture, and you have to be very conscious to co-create and bubble that up. Yes, you lead from the top, but you have to be seeking the input and advice from others. And I'll give some small examples. If a colleague in our one-to-ones, because I had very short one-to-one check-ins with colleagues on Fridays, and then if they needed more time, we would schedule more time, but usually it was just short, quick check-ins. And if a colleague was saying, you know, hey, in this meeting, I felt that so-and-so wasn't hearing me, then I would say, okay, it is important for you to bring that to so-and-so, not me. It's not up to me to be the peacekeeper or to like be the parent in that way, right? You are the leader, but you're not the parent. There's a difference. And so giving people the opportunity to say, you need to bring this forward to that person. And it's very okay to say, hey, I felt like I was bringing forward really good ideas. I felt like I wasn't being heard. And I just want to double check with you. So a lot of those sidebars would happen after group meetings. And I know for a fact they were extremely effective in working with people. And occasionally I'd give like the little nudge of like, oh, hey, I think you two should talk. Again, smaller environment, right? Smaller teams. It worked really well because we always knew we were operating with the best of intentions. Even at Cloudflare now, one of the values there is do the right thing. And I believe one of the other ones is assuming the best intentions, like assuming that others are doing everything that they can to help you. And so when everyone comes with that intention, it's a lot easier to avoid some of those snafus in terms of, you know, emotional labor and communicating. And I didn't feel it as much as a founder. I actually have felt it more at Cloudflare, particularly because I'm coming out of an ops role and into a retention role. And when you're on ops, you are kind of making the trains run on time. And it is extremely emotionally demanding. Even just hygiene of, hey, if we're posting messages in group chats, I need a thumbs up that you saw it and a check mark, like the emojis, reactions, right? A check mark that you did the thing. So then I don't have to follow up. We don't have to talk about it in group meetings, especially if we're communicating async. And so those little nudges matter. If I'm sending a first email about something, having reminders go out, but scheduling them right when I do it, because there is a lot of that. Well, I mean, but did you didn't remind me about it. It's like, didn't know that I had to, but no problem. So now I just, like, if I'm sending out a request or something a week out or then like 2 days before it's due, I'll preset all those reminder emails. So then I just do it once, but then everyone gets the nudges when they need it.
Yeah, you've kind of talked a little bit now about your role at Cloudflare, and you're now the head of biz ops or business operations. What kind of beliefs about building teams have you brought with you to Cloudflare? And what about that culture stood out to you when you were looking at opportunities?
I'm biased as a woman Canadian expat in the Bay Area, seeing Michelle Zatlyn as a woman Canadian expat in the Bay Area doing phenomenally well, and looking to that as someone as an example while I was building my company. Wanting to work at Cloudflare was a very easy choice in that regard. And then as I went through the interview process and got to know people, I will tell you right now, hands down, some of the nicest people you will ever work with. Now, that niceness cannot be okay in a, like, ineffective. You need to be nice and effective, and both have to go together. And that is a balance that we're definitely always working to improve. But the nicest, nicest people, like, just genuinely nice, I swear. Americans, but they seem like Canadian to me. Like, just some of the absolute nicest people I have ever seen or worked with. There's no undercutting and none of that vibe of, I'm sure you've seen the org charts where they have the org charts where, like, Apple, it's all around the one goal. And then, like, Google's like all the split teams in the hierarchy. And then Microsoft is like every team, like, being like, hey, stay away from me. So those org charts that are a hilarious way of talking about culture. You don't have as much of that here. There's definitely that understanding of, we have common goals. We need to achieve them. We are all part of the puzzle. And fortunately, in an ops role that I spent the last year in an ops role, you get to liaise with 12 to 17 teams. You get to be the person understanding what's important to that team and how to then convince them to do the thing that you need them to do for your team and how it definitely aligns with their goals, but you've got to convince them of that. And so it's been an exciting journey, and I'm very pleased with the culture and the people, most certainly. And I also have to credit even Manish Jindal, who I report to now, is phenomenal. Like, he has extremely high expectations for all of us. And it's just like the studies that they show in schools. When teachers have higher expectations, people actually rise to that bar. And so he has very high expectations, and I think he's doing a phenomenal job. And it's a great culture, again, where you have the niceness and the effectiveness. And that's just so critically important. And so I was struck by that in the interview process. I continue to be struck by that year and a half in. Rapidly growing company, completely at an inflection point of serious ongoing growth, and definitely an incredible opportunity to build a career at Cloudflare.
Yeah, that's great to hear. And I'm curious to know what your thoughts are around building culture. I mean, it sounds like your thoughts are, you know, be considerate, be a good person and do the job and get it done well. But are there any other ways that you think about building culture intentionally, whether as a founder or just the head of your department?
Yeah. So in building culture, again, it's the niceness and effectiveness hand in hand. That is really important to me. Obama recently was in a few articles with his new Netflix series on work, and he simplified work advice for the next generation into three words: get stuff done. I don't think I fully appreciated that as much in my 20s as I should have. That being said, you know, worked a full-time day job, was trying to get my company off the ground and teaching classes at the local college and night school. So, I mean, like, was definitely getting stuff done. But I think I didn't fully appreciate it the way he meant in terms of get stuff done for your team, get stuff done for others, move the needle. It's like, what is the stuff that you're actually getting done? That really matters. And so when it comes to culture, obviously, as I've said, we were a team at SquidSwap of 60% women, 30% visible minority, and underrepresented groups in tech. And this was self-identified by the team. They said, this is how we want to be recognized. And that is extremely important to me. And we also know from many studies, you'll hear me referencing studies a lot. I'm a voracious reader. I read a lot because I want to do best practices, not just in startups, but also in life. And certainly with culture, women are far less likely, if you ping them on LinkedIn, hey, I think you'd be great for this job. Most women are not going to look at that if they are not actively already thinking about leaving. Whereas most men, according to these studies, will just take the call, see what's happening. That builds your network, shows your credibility, gets a recruiter familiar with you. And women just aren't doing that. And so when I was trying to hire women, I would have to ask them 3, 4, and 5 times, be like, look, it's nothing about your current employer. I just want to have a conversation with you because I recognize that you have the skills and the talent. And regardless of what you think, I think you can do this. And even if you don't want to today, I'd like to have a conversation in case you want to tomorrow. And it takes more work to build diverse teams, full stop, period. And a lot of people take the lazy way out, especially when you're at companies where you're getting a disproportionate amount of applicants. Like, just the inflow is much, much higher. Even for a company at the size that we are, I believe on our last earnings call, we're, you know, at Cloudflare now, getting applicants far above the size of company that we are. It's disproportionate to the size, which is absolutely fantastic. But if you actually want to build diverse teams, in my experience from building a startup, you have to go out and find the people. You have to go out and constantly be networking. You need to know who the people are that are next up in your organization. And as I think about possible headcount and continuing to build out a team on my end, on the retention side, I'm thinking about, what do I want that team to look like? What are the skills that I need? How am I going to go out and start building relationships and just LinkedIn connecting with all the people that I see who seem to have had that experience? But Jason from Saster has a really great tweet recently that said, half of your hires should be experienced hires and half of your hires should be potential hires. And I loved that. I think that fully captures something we also miss a lot today, that you'll see jokes of, oh, I'm doing an entry-level position with 10 years experience, things like that, right? So to summarize, verbal processor, there's the example. So to summarize, really, it's you need to be hunting for that diverse talent. You need to be asking people over and over and over again to just take a no-stakes call. That's it. Like, this doesn't mean anything about me or about you or about your job or whatever. Let's just take the call. Let's get to know each other, because who knows where our careers are going to go. So that's number one. That's really important. And number two is, again, just hunting down, not just relying on who applies. And three, also not just relying on who is being referred, because if you have a similar demographic internally, they're just going to refer more and more of the same. And then the last piece being, hire half of a team that has done it before. You absolutely need that experience, but half of a team that is growing up into those roles, and be part of making someone's career. I still have people from SquidSwap who say, you know, the role you gave me in a tech company in Canada for 4 years completely changed the trajectory of my career. And the opportunities you gave me to then manage more people, like, and so quickly, that was huge for these individuals. And they still thank me for it to this day. And that's really important. I even find myself in the position of, hey, I know I haven't done this before, but give me the opportunity. Give me a chance, and I will be one of your potential hires, and I will get the job done.
Yeah, that's an awesome answer. And what would you say to hiring managers who are, you know, reaching out more to diverse candidates or underrepresented groups and not getting responses, or they're getting people to screen or start going through the process, but they're dropping out really quickly? At what point, or what things would you ask then those people to audit or look at in terms of their hiring process? Where could things be falling apart?
Yeah, it's interesting. I only had that happen once. So I don't know that I can speak too much from experience, but I can speak from what I would theoretically do in that situation. If you have a lot of diverse candidates who meet the qualifications but are dropping out partway through, it's really important, just like you do exit interviews, even with your company, like your the people who were employees and leave those exit interviews, it's also important, like, why did you stop this? And maybe that's as simple as picking up the phone. I find the best time for a cold call is 10 minutes on the hour. So at like 1:50, 10:50, it's just before someone's going to go into something else, assuming they're not too stacked. And usually you can say, hey, I know I'm catching you off guard. I know that we don't have a scheduled meeting. I just wanted to, the ask is find some time to ask you two quick questions. And then usually they'll say, well, we don't need to find time. You have me right now. What are your two quick questions? And then that's a really great way. It works in sales. In investor back channeling. Side note, this advice works really well with associates when you're trying to get the intel on partners at the firm. Anywho, so this is a technique I've used in other contexts, but that would also work for hires of like, hey, I know you dropped out of this process, totally okay. I would even, you know, riff on the language of like, is it me or is it you? Like, if it's you, that's okay, do your thing. But if it's me, what could I have done to be better? Because there may be gaps in, maybe they were only being interviewed by a bunch of dudes. That can happen. That's disheartening. I can say that from experience. It's really disheartening going through interview processes and all you see are a bunch of dudes and you're a woman trying to work somewhere. It can be sad. So who's doing the interviewing can certainly influence how people feel. Maybe it's even culture vibes. And it's totally okay if they're like, well, I got the sense that your culture is this, this, and this, like nice and effective. And I don't really want to be nice, but I want to be effective, right? Cool. Not a culture fit. No problem. But it's a learning opportunity for hiring managers. And I think the challenge today is hiring managers are facing an unprecedented opportunity of very high caliber talent available and a humongous influx of applicants. So they don't have time to be doing all the, you know, hi, I see you dropped out. Can I just, they are driven by and the incentives are aligned towards get the job filled. And again, short-sighted, but in these economic environments, we're not probably going to be spending as much time learning as we could or should, but I certainly hope that as things evolve and it becomes more competitive again and less of a hiring manager's market and more of an employee's market, if we, you know, eventually flip back to that, I think hiring managers do need to take the time to just as simple, is it me or is it you? What could we have done better? Because I bet you there are things that you can find that you can actively change.
Yeah, 100%. It's almost like a candidate would want to get feedback as well if they're, you know, rejected from process to improve for the next time, and hiring managers should be
doing
the same.
I've actually asked for that when I was interviewing at Cloudflare and elsewhere. And it's astounding to me how little you get back. I often would get the, you're a founder, you're like a Swiss Army knife, you can do all kinds of things, but you haven't done this one narrow thing of a business before. And I was like, you're right, I haven't, but I'm pretty sure I could figure it out. And they're like, yeah, you're very smart and I'm sure you could, but yeah, no, we're not going to hire. We're going to hire the person who did the very narrow thing. That's why, you know, from experience on both sides of the table, half should be experienced and half should be potential. But also it's like, you know, to your point, candidates, like, it matters the experience they have. And when I'm sending emails thanking people and asking for feedback in return, or when I'm exiting processes and when I joined Cloudflare and I emailed every single place I interviewed, whether they said no or I said no, and I told them where I landed and ask them to keep in touch. And not a single person actually, but people who I thought like we had good rapport, or if I'm sending them other candidates, hey, if you're still hiring in your org, I saw this person, they'd be great for you. And they're like not even answering. That to me is just wild. Because you're building a relationship, you're building a network, and I care very much. Yeah, I didn't go work for you, but I actually know someone who'd be even better than me for this position now that I've accepted elsewhere. Or, hey, this is where I landed, but I do want to stay in touch with the future because I was serious about wanting to work where you are. Right? So it's strange to me. I think that is a candidate experience that definitely can be improved.
Yeah, I think it goes back to everything you've said around playing the long game, especially on building relationships and building teams over time. You never know where someone's career will take them, or maybe you're not qualified today for something, but you're going to get that other job somewhere else, and then you'll have even better experience. I want to ask a final question before we go into our rapid fire questions, which we love to do. But you also serve as an executive coach to founders. So what issues around team building and remote work have you seen come up for the founders, you know, in your network that you work closely with?
Well, this comes from Carol Lehman, who's an incredible founder in Canada. And she said, hire fast, fire faster. And that has stuck with me for a very long time. So what I see a lot of the time with founders is that reticence to fire when it's not working out. And, you know, guilty as charged, been there, done that myself, right? But also a lot of the founders that I coach have a really hard time with it. And I'm the one who will come in a little bit more ruthlessly and say, hey, look, I'm the objective third party. I'm no two ways about this. You can be very kind to people and be building a business where, again, remember, the effectiveness matters. And so, unfortunately, whether it's the job, the company, their skills, their experience, whatever, if it's not working, you got to let them know and you got to move on as quickly as humanly possible. So that is something I see a lot in team building, culture, and hiring, just way too slow to fire if it's not working out. And that's where, you know, you can be kind, being kind and saying, this isn't working out. Best of luck. I've even said the words to junior engineer, hi, I messed up. I shouldn't have hired you because we don't have the bandwidth to give you the support you need. You're fantastic at so many things. We don't have the bandwidth to help you be the best coder you could be. That's on me. That's not your fault. That's my fault. I shouldn't have hired you in the first place. And I'm really sorry. And let me know how I can help you in any way. And then sending their resume off, helping them get into bigger companies that do have the capacity to do that. Like taking ownership and responsibility. Again, been there, done that. And that's really, really important. Obviously, my specialization areas for coaching are in fundraising, go-to-market, like, do you even have the traction to fundraise? And then OKRs, which leads into the traction of what are you doing every day, particularly those calendar audits, to achieve your goals. And then the sales piece, people often get nervous to like ask people for money. And the sales piece, whether you're selling to clients or particularly B2B, that's my area of expertise. So whether you're selling to clients or selling to investors or selling to people to join your team, sales is very much a founder job. So with those areas of expertise, you know, it's hard for founders right now. Funding has all but dried up. Customers' sales cycles are longer for startups and for large companies. They just are. People are much more meticulous about where every dollar goes. Funders are struggling. It's a really hard time right now. I do not envy, you know, my former peers. And I just want to be someone who's in their corner, who's not an investor breathing down their neck to get returns, who can be a calm, knowledgeable, trusted advisor to say, hey, I'm going to give you advice that is staunchly in your best interest, and you can choose to do with it what you will.
Yeah, definitely. I really do appreciate that you have the mindset of taking that knowledge that you built and sharing it, because that's what's really important in these times, especially when people are trying to figure out what their next move is. But before we tell people where to find you and let them know how they can get in touch, we'd love to just close out with our rapid fire questions. They're four very simple questions, a little personal, a little professional. But my first question for you is, what is your favorite interview question to ask candidates?
My favorite question to ask in interviews is some way of getting a vibe for how they respond under pressure or in conflict or when things are not going well. Like you're missing a deadline. You've realized it's Tuesday. You know, it's due on Friday. Tell me where you're at. Tell me where your next steps are. How are you moving through this? Or tell me about a time that you didn't do your best. And how did you recover from that situation? Because that will tell you a lot how someone responds under pressure.
Yeah, that's a good one. Second question is, what is an all-time favorite book that you would recommend?
It Doesn't Have to Be Crazy at Work by the Basecamp founders.
No hesitation. I love that.
Well, I'm assuming it was workbook. But yes, that's my favorite workbook.
It can be also a book for fun if you have one off the top of your head. Or last great book you read too.
I mean, I'm currently reading Brotopia, and that's just reinforcing Emily Chang, reinforcing all the things I lived. I'm almost like having PTSD reading it. Like, oh, I lived that.
I've heard that's a really good one.
It is excellent. Men should read it.
Yeah. Of course, yes. Where do you physically go to spark inspiration?
I love to walk along the water in San Francisco. So along the Embarcadero, by the ocean, water is really big for me.
Same, I like to do that in New York. What is something that you're really looking forward to right now?
I am really looking forward to nailing it on retention at Cloudflare. I'm exceedingly excited to be working on this. As I mentioned, it is a growth position for me. Haven't done it before. But figuring it out and really, really enjoying the opportunity to move the needle and, as Obama says, get stuff done.
That's awesome. a great point to close out on. So thank you so much for your time today and spending it with us. So many good nuggets for people to build their teams in a really culture first way.
Where can people find you, Melissa, when they, if they want to get any more of your coaching or read anything that you've written or hear anything that you've spoken about on other podcasts?
Conveniently, I have phenomenal SEO with Karjanakis as my last name. So if you Google me, a whole bunch of my podcasts will come up, including now this one, and certainly on LinkedIn. Best if you include a little note, because now the volume of sales LinkedIn requests, if there's no note on why you want to chat, I'm probably declining. But if you're like, oh, I need help with this, or ooh, can you point me to a resource on that? No problem. Happy to help. A lot of people helped me, and it's about paying it forward, as well as, you know, also working in more concentrated in arrangements as well.
Yeah, that's great. And we'll include all of that information in the show notes for people. But again, thanks so much for joining us, and stay tuned for the next episode, which we'll be releasing in a week.
How We Built Our Team is produced by Dover, a recruiting operations platform that helps you attract and engage the best talent.
You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and anywhere else that you listen to podcasts. See you next week.